Welcome to the Feminists for a People's Vaccine podcast, a space for imaginations, discussion, and feminist analysis from the Global South. In this creative journey, we approach the tough questions brought to light by the pandemic. Join us to look at this once-in-a-lifetime event as a passageway to imagine a fair and just world for all.
This is Gopakumar. I work with the Third World Network and I focus on intellectual property rights and implications on access to medicines. I am going to have a conversation with Dr. Marlies Richer. Marlies is a PhD in access to health services of sex workers in South Africa and Kenya. But that apart, she has a tens and tens of experience in public health advocacy as well as activism. So, you know, we will be basically extracting the information about her activism and its relevance in our present day time. So what we understand from your CVs and other information, you have a rich experience. You start in the public health activism. How did you start as a health activist or as an academic and then turn out to be a health activist? What really happened and what was those tipping points where you become a health activist? Could you share with us some of those memories?
My academic background is actually in English literature and some law and public health. And I studied for a master's degree in international peace studies and conflict resolution in the US. And after that, it really underscored to me the role of peace, the role of justice in getting to peace. And that was part of the big emphasis of my studies. And when I returned to South Africa after the year in the States, I started volunteering with the Treatment Action Campaign. And I worked at the AIDS Law Project that was partnering with the Treatment Action Campaign very closely. And this was in the early 2000s. South Africa was bent under the burden of HIV and AIDS. And the work that we did with the Treatment Action Campaign and the AIDS Law Project focused very much on treatment access for people with HIV. I was personally involved in advocating for post-exposure prophylaxis for rape survivors. And throughout our work, we challenged the stigma that attached to HIV and AIDS and the immense amount of discrimination that people in South Africa and the world were facing in the early 2000s with people's fears about HIV. And this work really brought home for me the importance of health and human rights, particularly the role of the criminal law inhibiting healthcare. So after this, it carried through these lessons in my work on sex work and health and human rights. I worked as a research inner city clinic in Johannesburg, reviewing the implementation of these services for sex workers. It was actually one of the first clinics in South Africa that had a sex worker friendly clinic. And the immense burden of criminal law and sexual morality that was being placed on society's most vulnerable and most marginalized women, that impact was just extraordinary. And I realized the need for access to healthcare services for sex workers, and that's where a lot of my research work has gone into. And I've combined that with advocacy and activism work, specifically on law reform on South Africa's old apartheid and colonial laws around sex work, and been advocating for the decriminalization of sex work. So the health activism has been a combination of work in HIV and AIDS and in sexual and reproductive health. And that's the experience that I bring to the Health Justice Initiative. That is the organization that I'm working at the moment. And that was forged in the July 2020, so in the thick of the COVID pandemic last year. And the organization focuses on health equity. And at the moment, we're particularly involved in vaccine equity and looking critically at the role of vaccines in South Africa and the continent and the impact of intellectual property protections on access to vaccines.
Marlies, how the pandemic is affecting the poor and marginalized communities in accessing healthcare as well as social security, because you have been focusing on this issue since the beginning of the pandemic.
The work that I am involved in have to do with sex workers, people without documents, especially undocumented migrants, and particularly marginalized people within society. And the COVID pandemic in so many ways have deepened these inequalities. And many people have lost their livelihoods. Many people have been driven to destitution. We have had so many job losses in the formal sector in South Africa, and then of course the informal sector at the same time. And the fear of accessing healthcare services have been particularly acute. People who would have gone to healthcare facilities to assist them with their routine healthcare, people needing to access their ARVs or their TB medicines, who've stopped doing so because of the healthcare system in South Africa buckling under the pressure of COVID patients. And I think those morbidity and mortality data will come even after the pandemic has ended in the knock-on effect of the healthcare system and the crowding out other illnesses. Our healthcare system in South Africa is really taking a lot of strain. We're moving into the third wave in the Western Cape, where I'm situated. And one of the key advocacy points that we are rallying around in South Africa at the moment is the inability of our registration system for vaccines to register people without documentation. So that's either homeless people who don't have access to documentation or people who are irregular migrants who don't have a visa or residential status. And not having an ID document means that you can't register on the vaccine system. And public health principles clearly show that everyone needs to be vaccinated, or you need to have at least 2/3 of the population vaccinated to make a sustained impact on the morbidity and mortality and the transmission of the pandemic. And yet there's this big gap in you not having documentation and not being able to access a vaccine. And I think the issue of xenophobia is a big rallying point in our engagement about the pandemic in South Africa. I'll perhaps conclude with the difficulties that sex workers face in South Africa. Sex workers criminalized, and especially under our lockdown that was quite severe, law enforcement played a very big role. Our military became involved, and there's been a number of human rights violations perpetrated by law enforcement in trying to enforce the lockdown regulations. And sex workers lost their livelihoods, and they have been persecuted by law enforcement, who now even have greater power over sex workers. And many sex workers have been unable to access healthcare, and who've also not been able to access information or the ability to register for vaccines. So if one thinks through the lens of health equity, it's absolutely important to focus on these groups of people who are being left behind. And if we want to reach universal health coverage, as the Sustainable Development Goals have set a challenge for us in 2030, these are groups of people that require additional attention, political will, and support to be able to benefit from vaccines and other interventions around COVID.
The message is very clear. The special people need special care. When we talk about public health, it is just not about the population alone. There should be extraordinary care should be taken to attend the special needs of the people who care for that. Then only we can achieve the real objectives of the public health. So the message is sound and clear. Do you see any deja vu moment when it comes to access and intellectual property rights, 20 years or almost 15 to 20 years down the line? Is it just a deja vu or deja vu plus?
Kopa, you're right. I think it's a plus for sure. It's as if the semblance is uncanny. We've seen with the COVID pandemic how monopolies have caused shortages within the pandemic, like N95 masks, ventilator valves, testing kits, reagents, and all of these being basically protected by intellectual property monopolies. And I looked at the recent statistics for COVID deaths and vaccinations, and we've only been able to fully vaccinate 15% of the world's population, and 1% of people in low-income countries have been vaccinated. And I think that shows to us, it's a big victory that we have been able to have COVID vaccines, that they work, and that millions of people have been able to access them. But on the other hand, there could have been many, many more if the intellectual property frameworks have been relaxed and that many more people could have accessed these technologies. So these are basically limited by intellectual property provisions and the lack of transfer of technical knowledge. And that's what we saw in the HIV epidemic as well. Around antiretrovirals, opportunistic infections where pharmaceutical companies were profiting off the pandemic. And when AIDS activists tried to challenge the patent rights, especially pharmaceutical companies backed by the US, would strongly resist that. When President Nelson Mandela passed an amendment to the Medicines Act that would allow for some relaxation in terms of intellectual property, there was a big outcry by pharmaceutical companies, and they actually took the government to court to challenge these provisions that would relax intellectual property. And the US put South Africa on a trade watch list, and due to the collaboration and global solidarity by activists, South Africa was successful in challenging that case. The pharmaceutical companies eventually withdrew the case and there was a settlement. And I think that was an example of the global solidarity that we're seeing once again around COVID and the People's Vaccine Campaign, the work that's being done by MSF with their access campaign, Oxfam, colleagues and friends and activists in Brazil, in India, in the US, many countries in the global north, now being immense pressure on countries who are blocking the TRIPS waiver. But these comparisons with the AIDS epidemic, I think, is very poignant. And I think we've been able to draw on the networks and the lessons learned with the AIDS epidemic that we are applying now within this pandemic.
But at the same time, the opponents are not showing any kind of regret on their position to protect the monopolies of the companies belong to them. But they are offering the vaccine doses to developing countries, saying that, you know, you don't have to produce. We will give you the sufficient doses, but without mentioning any time period or any kind of dates for even fulfilling their promise. So what's your take on this issue? Is it a kind of a tactics to sideline or to ease the pressure on waiver?
I think some of the issues that you mentioned go to the heart of the criticism around COVAX specifically, where it was set up as a mechanism for countries to be able to do conglomerations or coalitions of countries could come together to negotiate for bulk quantities of pharmaceutical products. And when one mentions the relaxation of intellectual property provisions, and I'd need to note that this is a very time-defined relaxation, the TRIPS waiver. It's not something that would go on forever. It's very well delineated for this public health crisis, which we know there's provision within the TRIPS agreement, especially through the Doha Declaration, that makes provision for the relaxation of intellectual properties to address a public health crisis. And many people say COVAX is the solution to some of these intellectual property contestations. What health activists say is we want change to the system. We don't want charity. People who are organizations or countries that are donating large amounts of vaccines, of course that's important and valuable, but it doesn't essentially alter the power relationships between, I think, the global north and the global south. And it doesn't make for good architecture for future pandemics, because there will be future pandemics. And being able to limit such scientific progress, especially if this has been partly funded by public money, being able to limit that to people or to countries that can pay for vaccines is inherently unjust, and that there is large-scale reform necessary, and that these TRIPS provisions need to be able to be passed for countries to get over this manufactured scarcity, as well as in conjunction with that, to develop countries' and regions' ability to manufacture medicines and manufacture vaccines. And I think there has been investment in local manufacturing, and those initiatives, of course, are also important, but they, in many ways, dependent on technical transfer, the transfer of tech from pharmaceutical companies. And if we don't have that, that's also being limited by intellectual property, the manufacturing would still be very limited.
Basically, these people are making the donations in a way to control the technology and to prevent the dissemination of the technology. So therefore, it's a charity in a way, in the name of charity, basically reinforcing the status quo. So this is what one of the criticism which you also brought out now. But at the same time, these people also, especially the political leadership from Germany or EU leadership, always say COVID vaccine is a global public good. What's your understanding of a global public good and whether it's matched with this mainstream idea of global public good articulated by maybe Chancellor Merkel or even French President Macron, etc.?
Yeah, Kupa, I think it's important to distinguish that intellectual property and global public goods need not be in opposition with each other. They can be complementary. And I think up to now, intellectual property claims have trumped global public goods in many ways. And it's perhaps good to spend some time just to unpack what a global public good is. And in the literature, it's interesting that a good is not seen as something necessarily bad or good. It's a concept like national defense or peace and security, global warming, that has a truly global impact. So in the health context, it's often a program or a policy or a service that has a global impact on health. And some definitions specifically talk about it as being non-rivalrous or non-excludable. And Ndivita Saxena talks about how within activism globally, there's been a call for COVID vaccines to be a global public good. In many ways, that's a signal that vaccines need to be equitable, that everyone should be able to access vaccines, and that vaccine equity should be the main consideration when one considers the pandemic and vaccines. And how intellectual property frameworks have now created this monopoly, and the pharmaceutical companies who've bought the intellectual property basically can decide who can access these vaccines and at what price. And this artificial scarcity has a devastating impact. And I think as a counterpoint to that, it's worth mentioning that in the beginning of the pandemic, Costa Rica proposed the creation of what they call the technical access pool, or CTAP, which would facilitate access to technologies to counter COVID. And pharmaceutical companies would be invited to voluntarily share their COVID-related knowledge, their intellectual property and their data. And it's very telling that not one pharmaceutical company has contributed to CTAP. And I think that really underscores how this notion of a global public good is not shared internationally, and how absolutely essential it is for the survival of many people and economies, if one thinks about the economic devastation that the pandemic has wrought.
From a human rights perspective, how do you view this delivering public good only through the voluntary measures of the corporations, while the human rights put the obligation, international obligation, on the state to act to protect the public human rights, especially in a public health crisis? It goes without saying that, you know, human right to health is irrespective of the pandemic or not, state has an obligation to protect the right to health.
Yes, and I think this is a contestation or a tension that the World Trade Organization particularly well grapples with. And I think the fact that the global pandemic is mostly decided by the World Trade Organization rather than the intervention of the World Health Organization is very telling. And the current power imbalances, the fact that lives in the global north seem to be much more valuable than the lives in the global south, argues strongly against this notion of something as simple as thinking about global health, because there isn't really global health. There's some people who have been vaccinated and who are relatively safe against COVID, and there are those who are dying. And I think that there's a huge injustice and a violation of human rights inherent in that inequality. And I think the Doha Declaration, just to go back to the provisions within TRIPS, makes provision for countries to take measures to protect public health and to promote access to medicines for all. Those are very specific provisions in paragraphs 4 and 6 that recognizes access to healthcare as a right. And the TRIPS waiver provisions that South Africa and India presented to the World Trade Organization in October last year recognizes this. And the waiver specifically talks about temporarily suspending intellectual property rights so that vaccines and other technologies can be accessible to poor countries, and to override these monopolies in many instances so that herd immunity is reached. And more than 100 countries have supported this waiver and acknowledges the importance of vaccines and technology as being a public health good. But at the same time, there are a couple of countries that are blocking the waiver and who doesn't recognize this human rights framework. And it's mostly countries in the global north, if you look at the map of countries supporting the waiver and those blocking it. And tellingly, it's the European Union. The United States has recently changed their position on the waiver and have made amendments specifically in supporting the waiver around vaccines, which is great, but not necessarily other technologies. And it's countries in the European Union, Japan, and Norway, Australia, who's blocking the waiver. And it's interesting to see, especially in terms of the number of vaccines that have been purchased by these countries blocking. In Canada, they have enough vaccines to vaccinate this population more than 9 times. European Union, 3.5 times of doses per person. While in the African Union, for example, at the beginning of the year, there weren't enough vaccines for even 0.2% of the population of Africa. So there's this terrible irony about countries that have more vaccines than they know what to do with, but blocking the avenues for other countries who don't have to make those accessible. And I think the TRIPS waiver is absolutely the rallying point for us in the pandemic at the moment. And the Director General of the World Health Organization, as you might recall, has talked about this vaccine nationalism, vaccine apartheid, as a catastrophic moral failure, and that it's something that we need immense political will and pressure and activism around.
The Feminists for a People's Vaccine podcast is produced by Dawn, Development Alternatives with Women for a New Era, and TWN, the Third World Network. Today's episode was edited by Alice Furtado and engineered by Ernesto Sena. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Banita Nayak Mukherjee. See you on the next episode.